Hello, everyone. Hey, welcome back to another episode of The Emergency Room Sucks. It's your girl, Bethany D, and I am here with Isaac.
Good morning, everybody.
Our favorite co-host, and we have a very new guest today. Jim, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jim Bridges. I am a retired registered nurse. I did 31 years, starting out as a brand new grad. I went straight into an ICU at Harbor UCLA. It was jumping off the board into the deep end of the pool and not sure I could swim adequately, but I did find that some of my experience in the Marine Corps surfaced. That is to be recognizing a new situation and analyzing it and adapting the appropriate actions to deal with it. That's kind of like my primary motivation in everything I do. But as I say, I'd worked 31 years. I did 10 years at Harbor UCLA.
Wow.
When I departed that institution, I was the supervisor for the neuro intensive care ICU. We handled everything from gunshots to the head, car wrecks, spinal injuries, neurological problems, strokes, etc. Very complicated and seldom rewarding. But when you get a win with a head trauma patient who's been on a ventilator for a month and they come back to see you and tell you how they appreciated what you did for them, that's a warm fuzzy that hangs with you for quite a while.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. So you are actually a coworker of Isaac. How did you guys meet, Isaac? How did you guys get together to come to do this podcast?
Well, I met Jim when I got hired at St. Francis back in 2002. And it was, he probably doesn't realize this, but it was somewhat of an intimidating experience. Before I met Jim, I only had 2.5 years experience under my belt when I got to St. Francis. And as I was being given the round, as I was doing the rounds of meeting everybody, it was Felix who introduced me to him. And the guy who was training me, his name was Felix, Jose Felix. He was an EMT, and he was letting me know everybody's experience compared to mine. So night shift was leaving, and he was letting me know this person has 10 years plus experience, 15 years plus experience. This guy has multiple specialties. I meet Jim. He's like, hey, this is Jim. He's in a shitload of stuff, multiple certificate or specialties, and has more than 20 years experience.
Nice.
Then I went to meet him. That was my introduction to Jim. He was as down to earth as can be, more than willing to teach me if I had a question. He doesn't remember this, but I once asked him, I said, how do I wrap this arm? And he just basically showed me how. I knew how, but I was nervous. But that's what Jim was. He was more than willing to show me the ropes of anything he could show me.
Nice.
That's how I met him.
And how long had you been a nurse, Jim, before going to St. Francis?
About 20 years.
Oh, wow. So you've been in this a long time.
I got my license in 1977.
Oh, get out of town. So when did you serve in the military?
I went in the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old in 1962.
Get out of town.
And I got a medical discharge in 1967, so I've been right at 5 years.
Were you born and raised in California?
No, I'm originally from Texas, but California is my adopted home forever. I love it here.
Okay.
Hey, Jim, when you went to the Marine Corps, where were you? What's the word I'm looking for? Where did they send you?
Oh, station?
Station, not the word.
I started at Camp Pendleton in the 1st Tank Battalion and did right at a year there where I attended a tank crewman school. And then I got the opportunity to be transferred to the 3rd Tank Battalion, which was stationed in Okinawa. And while you're there on the island of Okinawa in tanks, they are constantly sending out what are called battalion landing teams, battalion infantry with all supporting arms and so forth. And you go to designated places for training for about 6 to 8 weeks. And so I got to spend time at the base of Mount Fuji in Japan.
Nice.
One of the most remarkable sights in the world is seeing the sun come up and reflecting off the snow on the top of Mount Fuji. It's just beautiful.
Nice.
Then back to Okinawa, and then we went to the Philippines. And while we were in the Philippines, we stopped, did a port call in Hong Kong for a few days, back before it was that giant replica of Manhattan. And so it's back in the old days.
He said a giant replica of Manhattan.
That's what it looks like today. I mean, you can't recognize it.
Nice. Did you practice nursing while in the military?
No. Becoming a nurse never entered my mind at that time.
No. Can you describe any medical emergencies that you saw overseas?
Yeah. One morning, about 6:30, quarter to 7, and it heard an explosion. And it turns out that across this little ravine was a company of infantry, and a night patrol had returned. And the squad leader was collecting all of the hand grenades. Well, some of the infantry have a tendency to loosen the pin on the hand grenade, so if they have to throw it, it's not a struggle to pull it out.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had loosened theirs and not put it back into a safe position. The young corporal had an armload of hand grenades. He was going to return back to the armory. One fell, and it happened to be the one with a loose pin, and it exploded.
Oh, man.
Inside a tent full of troops who had just come in from patrol. Outside, a young man was standing at a wash basin with a little mirror on it, shaving. The blast came through the side of the tent and emasculated him. Whoa!
Oh,
lots of, evisceration type wounds, evulsions, etc. Things like that. Yeah. When I was in the hospital, I received not a combat wound, but more like an industrial accident wound. We went into a dry riverbed, and the hatch that I was standing in, I went down inside the tank, had my hand up in the hatch to steady myself, and as the tank went over the edge of the draw, the hatch slammed shut on my hand and broke off 4 fingers on my left hand, and 2 had to be amputated.
Oh, wow. And,
so I got my first morphine ever in my life, and my first helicopter ride.
I bet the morphine ride was better than the helicopter ride.
Yeah, really. The morphine made everything sort of surrealistic.
Yeah.
So when they put me aboard the helicopter, it was probably maybe 100, 102 degrees in on the ground.
Yeah.
And he went straight up to a couple of thousand feet, and then the trade winds blowing in off the ocean, the China Sea, dropped the temperature probably down into the low 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa! So I went from intense heat to pretty extreme cold.
Oh, wow.
Machine gunner gave me a cigarette, and I just ripped the ride over to the hospital.
Wow.
Did you get the cigarette after that, or were you discharged from there? I was sent from Vietnam to the Philippines. It was just a transition, and then the next day went to Japan to the hospital there. Didn't really do much. I was just being evaluated, and they sent me back to Camp Pendleton, and they sent me home. told me come back and we'll evaluate. Eventually, I wound up in front of a medical review board, and just to give you an understanding of the treatment of the wounded troops at that time, I was denied a disability.
Wait, huh?
Luckily,
You were denied disability despite the injury you had?
Yes, they said it wasn't severe enough to rate a disability that I could go check with the VA.
Okay. Well,
I thought, oh, wait, the Marine Corps had something to do with my injury, so I'm going to pursue it. And I had legal representation. It was great. It was a captain. He was an attorney from Boston. And he says, this is all I do is represent you guys. And he says, all I do is write rebuttals to their findings. And he says, I always win. My people always get what they deserve. He says, I don't know why they go through this kangaroo court. But sitting in the hallway waiting to be interviewed, there were young guys missing arms, missing legs.
Wow.
Really. And the pathetic and sad part was that one kid says, they're going to give me $3,000 cash and provide me with the money to buy a car that I can operate because I'm missing some body part. Good Lord. Yeah, and I told him, I said, you know, that cash is not going to last that long.
Right.
Seems like a lot of right now, but it's not going to last you long. And that car is not going to last you forever. So when you have to buy a new car with those same things, it's going to be out of your pocket. I said, no, man, get the money from them now so it'll be there for the rest of your life. It's tax-free, et cetera.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know if I convinced any of them not, but just to show you, you know, people are complaining about inflation today. When I got my first check from the Marine Corps for my disability, it was
$80. $80?
Yeah, it was $80.
No way.
But my rent in Compton was $75.
What?
Yeah, that's how things were back in the 60s. And today, that $80 increased by the consumer index increases. Anyway, the $80 is now $647.
Oh, wow.
So when people say, oh, things cost too much and I remember when. Yeah, but if you take whatever that $80 was worth in 1967 and then convert in today's dollars, you see the huge increase. So
we've been
going up the scale for a long time, slowly enough to where people don't pay attention.
Yeah. And I complain every single day, especially when I have to get gas. Woo!
Oh, yeah. I guess. Jim, when you were discharged and you came back, where'd you settle? Did you come back to Oklahoma or go to Texas?
Well, I had met my wife when I was stationed in Barstow, and she lived in Compton, and so, you know, going to her house and so forth. And after I got out, we got married at 3 o'clock in the morning in Las Vegas before I could be allowed.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. That is cool.
Yeah. But within 6 to 8 weeks of the time we got married, I was on a plane going to Vietnam. So when I came home, you know, staying with my wife at her parents' house. And then after I got discharged, we lived with them for a while. And I got a job, and through a friend of a buddy of mine in the Marine Corps, we used to go visit his aunt and uncle from New York. They lived in Hollywood, so we used to go to visit them on the weekends and terrorize all the bars in Hollywood for the weekend. So
nice.
And then, like I said, we got an apartment in Compton, and we moved to Linwood and stayed in Linwood two or three places. But along the lines, I was working. Wound up working as a machinist, making drill bits for oil wells.
Hmm.
So, Jim, when you started doing all of that and transitioned over to nursing, the question is, what transitioned you over to wanting to be a nurse?
Actually, it was totally just chance. I was attending Compton College and taking the general education things that would apply to whatever major I finally decided upon. And I got called into the counselor's office, and they told me, said that I was now at the halfway mark to an associate degree. And I could not take any more classes unless I declared a major. And so I, having worked with machinery, I thought, well, I'm probably interested in something in the medical field. You never run out of customers.
Right.
So I told the counselor, you know, respiratory therapy, x-ray tech, something along that line. And she was looking at my folder, and she says, well, your GPA, et cetera, why don't you look into pre-med? And I go, well, I'm already in my late 20s, and by the time I got through with all the education, I would be in debt up to my ears and just beginning to earn money. And all the whole time, I have a wife and two children. So, I don't think I could. That would fit into my plans. So then she asked me this question, and it kind of took me back for a moment. She says, well, what about nursing? And I'm looking at her, I said, what for?
That's what I said. Like, hell no. Initially, my mom was like, become a nurse. I was like, no freaking way.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, she says, try it for one semester, see if you like it. Well, what the hell, you know, that's only 3.5 months. So I did. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to Isaac yesterday, I believe it was, and I told him that, first of all, I was one of three Caucasians in my class.
Wow.
And most were, you know, people who lived in Compton and Watts and South Central around the area.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, your Filipino contingency, et cetera. But I had the fortune of being befriended, taking into the fold of some ladies who were LVNs.
Nice.
And some of them had 15, 20 years experience. They become LVNs in order to support their families. 90% of them were single moms. And anyway, they adopted me. And I'd never worked in a hospital. I didn't know how things worked.
Mm-hmm.
And they're describing it in a classroom, and it's kind of hard to conceptualize or visualize, you know, some of the things you're talking about if you've never seen it.
Yeah, because at this point, you're like a fish out of water. Like, this is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I had the benefit of all my prerequisites were behind me. So I picked up some information that, you know, helped relate to what was being discussed in class. But when we got to clinic, I was lost. You know, I was a stranger in a strange land. So one of my newfound friends would say, what kind of patient you got, how bad are they, what do they need, and they would just give me, you know, like a verbal walkthrough of what a shift would be like with this patient.
Can you explain why that was such a benefit or a blessing? I think a lot of people who aren't in nursing don't realize how intimidating or how lost a person can feel when that's new to them.
It is, and I was a little hesitant sometimes. I grew up in the South. Men don't touch other men's bodies. Yeah, it's just that way. So having to give some guy a bed bath, that was like I really have to work on this for a while.
It's like, before, you know, you want me to do what?
You know, I totally get that. I totally get it. Like you said, grew up in the South as a man. It is, for me at least, it was somewhat of a culture shock. Like, I'm supposed to do what?
Yeah. You want me to touch it?
Why is it looking at me? No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like a cyclops.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
And it was interesting because some of my own experiences after I was wounded gave me insight into some rather minor tasks. First time I ever saw my hand after they did the amputations, it was wrapped in a giant boxing glove bandage. And I was in the hospital in Yokosuka, Japan. I was called down to one of the clinics, and the Navy corpsman says, the doctor wants to examine your wounds. I said, okay. Man, I'm thinking, like, I kind of like to see what it looks like, too. Because to me, I still think those fingers are there. Yeah, that ghost sensation. And anyway, he started, he cut it open and started to feel it back. And, you know, the exudate had adhered to the bandage and the wound. So as he started to peel it back, it was sensitive, so I kind of winched. I said, that hurt.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Jim, but just for the audience, when he says ghost sensation, he's not seeing a ghost. What he's talking about is thinking, or the body reminding him that the fingers are still there, even though they may not be. You get that sensation that your limb is there.
Phantom sensation, I believe it's called.
Phantom pain, yeah. Phantom sensation.
Sorry, go ahead, keep going. So anyway, he was pouring a little peroxide in there to, you know, break up the adhesion, and then peeling it back. Well, this doctor walks in, reached over and grabbed the bandage and just ripped it off.
Oh!
And the pain was so intense, I almost passed out.
Oh, no.
The corpsman, he caught me. If he had not caught me, I would have fell face first onto the floor. And the doctors, in a very stern and loud voice, says, I told you I wanted this wound ready for examination when I walked in.
Mm-mm.
Corman tried to explain to him why he was taking longer for my benefit. And he says, I don't care about that. Whoa.
Wow.
And then the egomaniac looked at the wounds and goes, yeah, okay, and left.
Mm-mm.
He didn't do anything, just looked at him. So later, much later, I was doing home care. And I went to a lady's house who had bladder cancer and had surgery and had to do a dressing change. And so a woman about my age, a little older, and I told her, I said, I'm here to do your dressing change. And she says, okay. I said, well, I have a question. Do you have a problem with me as a man changing your dressing due to the location? And she goes, no, not if you know what you're doing. That's okay. So I looked at it, and I could see that there was, you know, some crusty stuff from the oozing. I used the peroxide, softened it up, and I peeled it away like an onion. And got it cleaned up, redressed it. And she says, well, thank you. And I said, certainly, you take care, blah, blah, blah. Well, as luck would have it, a few months later, I attended a birthday party or something with my son-in-law's family. So I walk in and being introduced to people, and this lady whom I don't recognize was the lady I did the dressing change on.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Turned out to be a good friend of my son-in-law's mother. And she says, you don't remember me. And I says, I'm sorry. She said, you came to my house and you did a dressing change. I had the, I can recall. And she turned around to the whole room. She says, this man has the most gentle hands I've ever experienced. It says, he came in and changed my wound, my dressing, and I never felt a thing. Whereas the other people, it was always a little bit uncomfortable.
That's awesome. Well, that's really awesome.
Having had the same experience, I tried to prevent, you know, any undue discomfort. And those little things are other events that stick in your mind over a great number of years, but gives you a little consolace for all the bad stuff.
That's actually really good. And it's always great to see a patient after you've taken care of them. And, you know, you're just going about doing your day and you're doing your job and you're doing your best. And then that person comes back to say, hey, you made a difference in my life. That's really awesome. Yeah,
it is. It truly is. And again, you don't, as you go through life, you don't really understand or not aware of the impact that you make on other people.
Yeah,
and you're just doing the thing, and they're looking at it through their eyes and their experiences, and has some degree of impact.
Yes, that's awesome.
When you were doing home nursing, were you also at Harbor UCLA?
No, I've been gone from there for over 10 years.
When Bethany, when we spoke yesterday, he let me know that he had. You were one of the original three CCT nurses in the field?
Yeah, I was.
Was this during that time?
That would have been 1987.
1987. You were one of the first CCT nurses in 87?
Yep.
Wow.
It was a company who started in San Diego. And it was sort of like a registry, but it was for nurses to do transports. And so they grew enough business in San Diego. They thought, well, Los Angeles is a heck of a lot bigger market. So they made a contract with a small ambulance company over in El Monte, which I'm sure is no longer in business. There were three of us. We worked 24-hour shifts, and they gave us a company car, and all defibrillator, everything was in that, and we would go and meet the ambulance crew either at the sending hospital or at the station, make the transport, they'd take me back to the car, and I'd get my equipment and either go home or go get a call and go to another hospital. But there were three of us, and nobody else in the LA area had a designated transport nurse. The hospitals just sent, you know, usually the nurse taking care of the patient to transport them to another hospital, and then they bring the nurses back to the hospital.
Yeah. So we're going to take a small little break, but when we come back, I want you to kind of explain what a CCT nurse is. And we'll kind of take it from there.
Okay.
All right. Just a little break, guys. We'll be right back. All right, guys. We are back, and we still have Jim here, who has given us a really great history in nursing. So, Jim, before we left off to our break, you told us that you were one of the very first CCT nurses. For those of you guys who don't know, CCT stands for Critical Care Transport. Jim, tell us about your experience with that and what a CCT nurse is.
Well, my introduction to it was the initial CCT or CCT services in LA County. They hired three nurses to work 24-hour shifts, one on per day, and we were given a company car with a defibrillator, IV pumps, and so forth. We would meet ambulance crews at hospitals that needed to transport them patient to another facility, either for insurance purposes or need for specialized or higher level of care. And we'd do our transports. They would take me back, drop me off, and I'd hang out until the next call came in. Critical care transport nursing can be sometimes mundane. It's just because somebody's got a IV drip that has a medication that has the potential of being harmful, to regulate that, monitor the response. And sometimes you get people that are going in for heart transplants and they got four or five IV pumps and a ventilator and everything else going in the back of an ambulance. So it can go from
work that I would compare to working on a ward to work that would put me in the recovery room. That level of care, and you're the only nurse. There's a strip of the Hollywood freeway that you go down, and there's a certain area that the pavement is rough, and you hit it, and it looks like your patient just went into AFib.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, everything.
When you started doing this, were there any specifics on what you could or couldn't do as a critical care transport nurse? Was there anything you were told that was allowed or wasn't allowed? Or were you given a vast, generalized idea of what to do?
In all honesty,
yeah,
they just said, you're an ICU nurse. You know what to do. And that was it.
That's usually how it goes, right?
Yeah.
Alrighty. There you go.
I mean, you had the drugs, you know, to use for CPR and arrest and so forth. But yeah, there was no bylaws, rules, or anything that was in writing. And then as the concept advanced and other ambulance companies started hiring nurses, and it became competitive, then you had a ride-along with one of the nurses that worked at whatever new company you moved to. You'd do a ride-along with them, and then they'd do a ride-along with you to evaluate your performance.
Mm-hmm.
But it really wasn't anything cut and dried. It's just, you know, you did what you did is necessary within the scope of your practice.
And when you went there and you transitioned over to St. Francis, what is it you went in for? Did you go straight to the ER? Did you go back to the ICU and then transition over to ER?
Actually, I hired in as a supervisor for the GI lab.
Nice.
And I ran that for 2 years. I won't call it an altercation. I'll just say a disagreeable experience with the physician.
Okay.
I've been there, done that.
Yeah. I've had many disagreeable conversations with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm standing there and he's being an asshole.
There's no other word.
Well, yeah, exactly. Anal orifice will do for the more sensitive. But, you know, once you've had experiences enough times in your life, at some point they're all going to come together and you're about to explode. So I'm standing there clenching my fist thinking, should I punch him in the nose or should I just go straight for the throat?
Mm.
But then I thought, well, there goes my life. There goes my livelihood. So I just told him, today's my last day. And he goes, you're quitting? And I says, I am. So luckily, the lady who was in charge of the ER was covering the surgery and the GI and the recovery area in the absence of the supervisor who was on vacation. So she comes up and tells me, she says, I heard you just quit. I says, I did. And she says, well, won't you reconsider? I says, I cannot work with that man. And seeing how he's the predominant position in this lab, I have to see him on a daily basis and deal with him. So no, I can't guarantee that I won't misbehave. Oh, she says, well, would you like to work in the ER?
I love your choice of words, Jim.
Thank you. So I says, well, I can't do nights. And she says, no, we have an opening on days. I says, yeah, if I can get days. And she says, well, you're already a certified critical care nurse, right? I said, yeah. She says, well, you'll start at the top of the salary.
Nice.
Well, yeah, which created some degree of hostility amongst the nurses who work in the ER when I walked in. Like, why is this new guy getting to come on today when there's people on nights who've been there for years who want to come on days?
Yeah.
And I understood. I was just offered an opportunity. I didn't try to create it or cultivate it. And I barely even knew the supervisor at the time. But then again, you're saying you have an MICN license. So did I. And when I got my paycheck later, there was no difference in the money.
Not at all, dude.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Well, at that time it was. At that time there was a increase of, I don't know what turned out to be dollar amount, but anyway, so I asked, I says, aren't I supposed to start making more money now, MICN? And they go, you're a critical care nurse, so that's equal to an MICN as far as pay goes. And so consequently, you are already getting the max.
That's some straight up bullshit.
When you guys go from being a nurse, and because MICN is a specialty, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. There's no incentive for getting that license. They just go ahead and keep you where you're at.
Well, for those of you who don't know, MICN is Mobile Intensive Care Nurse. And basically what that nurse does is they guide what's called pre-hospital care through the paramedic ambulance. So if you call 911, a paramedic responds, or an EMT, and or an EMT. And then that paramedic, depending on your complaint, has to call what is called the MICN, a base station, to get directions and, you know, guidelines on what to do. So unfortunately, because you get that extra, you know, you get that education, unfortunately, you don't get paid for it. You have to continue to grow in your nursing career to start to get benefits from that. But the MICN only, I guess you get credit for guiding pre-hospital care. That's really all you do. It's beneficial for education as a nurse, but not necessarily financially.
So I guess that applied to you, Jim. It was good for education, but not financially.
Yeah. You might add that the MICN licensure is a bit of a challenge.
Yes.
The class that you take in preparation for the examination is, I think I went one day a week for 6 weeks.
Me too.
And luckily, the lady teaching the class had been in the MICN business for a long time. Her husband, or ex-husband, as she called him, was her battalion commander, so she knew all about the fire department, the paramedics, and so forth. So she was a great instructor. The class was great. I learned a whole lot. I brushed up a lot of knowledge that I hadn't had to use in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, but again, it is a challenge to obtain that license.
That's interesting, you guys. I didn't know that. I'll leave it at that.
You should definitely be paid for it, but unfortunately, there is no standard to get paid for it. I mean, you do it because you want to do it. You enjoy nursing. You know, for me, you know, I loved trauma and I just loved, you know, knowing that I was affecting somebody's care out in the field. I didn't care about getting paid for it. I really didn't. I just liked the title.
It's something I'm proud of.
I'm sorry, Jim, to interrupt, but one of the I guess the joys of working with you in that time was your, I don't want to call it laid back attitude, but you weren't fazed by what I consider to be highly intense moments. I remember you being calm, not casual, but calm, I guess focused on what was going on. How did you apply your military background? I don't know if that's appropriate to say, with it being an ER nurse. Did any of that affect, like, one overlap over the other with
past experiences into the ER, or did the ER remind you of certain situations in the military?
Well, I had made this comment a few times when I worked in the emergency room at St. Francis. And I told the younger nurses, from my observation, the only difference between working there and being in Vietnam was that at St. Francis, you could not shoot back.
All righty.
Which was a bummer sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I swear to God, I got in more physical altercations working in the ER than I had in my entire life.
With staff or with patients?
With patients.
Yeah.
Never had. We had a great crew, and everybody worked well together. There were some strong personalities that would clash from time to time, but yeah. That was incidental and forgotten the next day.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, you know, people laying there in the bed. The next thing you know, they're swinging and punching and biting and kicking, and
yeah,
you have to subdue them.
So you hear that, people? Working in the ER is harder than fighting for our country.
At times, it equates, yes.
That's crazy.
So as Jim told us earlier, now keep in mind, Bethany, when I met him, I was as green as it gets, right? Because 2.5 years on an ambulance really doesn't match your time in an ER. Mm-hmm. You think it does as an EMT. When I went into St. Francis, I realized quickly how green I was, mm-hmm. and how much I didn't know.
Yeah.
I went in with quite an ego, and my first day left St. Francis thinking they're going to fire me.
Yeah.
I didn't make it through day two.
Me too. And I had been a nurse 4 years before coming to St. Francis.
It was that intimidating.
Yeah.
But what I did enjoy about my time with Jim, So what fingers are you missing, Jim?
The first two of my left hand, the ring finger of my left hand. I don't have full flexor range of motion, and I've got arthritis in that hand.
He used that to his benefit. I remember you mind if I bring up, Jim, how you used it with certain patients?
No, not.
I know he did it once with a kid, and at the kid, how'd it go? Because I know you did it quite a few times, and I actually did appreciate it, because I realized that you could have a sense of humor in the ER and take your job seriously. Mm-hmm. Well, I think I went a little too far on the sense of humor, but still, that's beside the point. I know Jim used that to his advantage with treating patients. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind giving us a few stories about that.
I was doing triage, and a woman brought a little boy in. He was around, I don't know, maybe six. And he had something wrong with his hand, injured, I believe, and may have had a foreign object. The details are blurry. But he didn't want to be touched. He didn't want to see the doctor. He didn't want to do this. He didn't want to do that. And so I just looked at him and called him by name and said, here's the story. If you don't let us fix your hand, you're going to look like me. And I held my two stubby fingers up in front of his face and wiggled them at him. And his eyes got so big. And he's like, oh! He cooperated after that.
Hey, you got to do what you got to do, right?
You do what's necessary. He also told me a story once about how he walked up to a patient who had a similar injury. You mind telling us a little about that?
Yeah. I come walking by, and it was bed two, I think it was. A man had been brought in an industrial accident. He had self-amputated by the whatever kind of machinery he was using, the first two fingers, the same two fingers that I lost. And they were laying in the Emerson vases and ice at the overbed table. And I walked by and I looked at two fingers, looked at him, and he was sitting up. He's awake and alert. And obviously he was pain-free. And I looked at the fingers. I looked at him. I said, hey, I'll give you $20 for those fingers. But then the guy looked at me. He was like, what? And so I showed him my hand. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm going to have to withdraw that offer because the colors don't match.
I cannot. Oh, my God.
The guy looked at me and I said, dude, listen, I've been this way for, you know, over 20 years. You'll learn to adapt. It's not a big deal.
Oh, my God.
I was once in a trauma. And I don't know what I smelled in there that sent me back to my childhood. Where I grew up, it was it's the Mar Vista Projects, and it's on the western part of Clover City. Mm-hmm. There are certain smells when certain things would happen that wouldn't remind me of spring, autumn, or summer. Certain smells reminded me of drive-bys or certain events. It's just that's just the way it is.
The blood, you know? Smell, yeah.
Yeah.
So one day a trauma comes in, I get that smell and I have a flashback. I think Jim caught it. He looked at me and goes, it's okay. If you have these moments, just acknowledge it. He goes, every once in a while, I'll get a smell. And I think you said it reminded you of your tank days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You just have to absorb it and move along. Don't let it overwhelm you. I don't know if that's accurate. I don't know if certain smells reminded you of your time in Vietnam. Is that, I know I had that conversation with you. But
the tanks we had were diesel. So when you start them up or when you step on the gas to start to move, there's a large expulsion of diesel exhaust, just like a city bus. And you get a face full of that, you know, it's impressive, stays with you. And to this day, if I'm someplace and again, behind a large truck or city bus that's spewing out black exhaust, my mind will go right back to Vietnam. And
wow.
It's actually, they've done studies and they have come to the conclusion that smell is the strongest of your senses to stimulate past memory.
Mm.
So with comatose patients, you know, you're trying to get some of their synapses to start to spark, and you do, you know, your stimulation, rub them with a, you know, like the velvet glove type thing or something that's a little more coarse with texture to it, give them things to taste, but they found that smell would bring about a response more predictably than any of the other senses. So we would have, depending on the patient was a male or female, we would ask the spouse or significant other to bring in the fragrance, be it aftershave lotion or perfume, and just put a little bit on a piece of gauze and lay it on their chest or something so they could get the smell. And you actually do start, people respond to that.
Nice. Interesting.
I mean, laying there like a vegetable, and you put a little Old Spice under their nose, and they'll start to, you know, shoulders will start to wiggle, or their eyes will flutter. It's, you know, it's not 100%, but it's a good tool. And, recognizing that those smells will stay with you for life because they are associated with something significant in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's awesome.
Well, you know, Bethany, I actually used that experience with him later on with other people I worked with. I didn't know exactly how to handle it. Mm-hmm. I was able to get through it. But later on, whenever I came across other EMTs who'd have a moment, I'd let them know, look, it's okay. If it reminds you of something, that's fine.
Yeah.
Take it in. Don't let it overwhelm you. It's okay. Do your job, and we can work with it afterwards. It happened a few times.
That's awesome.
I'm fortunate to have come across him, because it's small things like that, Jim, that a guy who's brand new, as I was, doesn't realize it's just part of the growing process.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, when I got there, I think the average time the staff had as nurses was more than 10 years.
Yeah.
15 years. That's mm-hmm. the stuff I came into, Bethany.
Well, that's the case in most experiences in education. When you do healthcare, a lot of people think that it comes from the theories and the clinicals that we do when we go to school. It's not. It's from the experiences of other healthcare members. Almost everything I learned as a nurse, believe it or not, was through Aileen. When Aileen was in her trauma days before she became, you know, a little bit more hard to get around, before it became harder for her to get around, Aileen taught me a shitload about trauma. And if it wasn't for her, I never would have been the trauma nurse that I was.
Mm-hmm. You know, Aileen was really good at teaching me a few things. I actually had, but you know, I can't pinpoint one thing, Beth, to one person, but you have guys like Jim. I had Aileen at night. And then I had, it was Angie Besant.
Oh, hell yeah, Angie, yes.
There was our manager, the former director during days when I got there, her name was Nikki, Yes. And her thing, what Nikki and Angie taught me was empathy. They said, you mm-hmm. have to learn empathy mm-hmm. because you can't do it if you don't have it. And everybody gave me, I mean, I can go on and on. But that experience these people have translates over to people who are new. Mm-hmm. They're willing to listen and willing to learn. It's something you'll never get anywhere else.
Yeah. Those are the best teachers.
I think, you know, Jim, I don't think people appreciate enough your experience. When you left St. Francis, I'm upset to say that you left on a bad note.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the most, I'm not going to say the most, but it was at the time, to me, because I was still fairly new, I only had about a few years under my belt at the place, it was just shocking. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand it, only to deal with it later on. That's besides the point. Mine was, Jim shouldn't have left the way he left, Bethany.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like how he was asked or the way he left.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel deserving of his time as a nurse or his experience.
Mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable talking about that, Jim?
Yeah, you know, my only regret is that I did not get an attorney, because I probably could have settled for a significant amount of money because of the way they handled a bogus accusation against me and the people that I supposedly had offended or hurt actually testified to HR. It never happened, and they, you know, that I was actually a supportive and reliable person, and it was just somebody had me in their sights, and they decided they'd create innuendos. It was kind of like a Republican smear campaign. None of it's true, but if we put it out there, you know, enough times, people will start to think, well, maybe, you know.
And on that note, we're going to take one small little break, and we're going to come back and hear about what happened. All right, guys, we are back, and we still have Jim and Isaac here. And Jim is giving us a really good dialogue about what happened to him when he was at St. Francis. Jim, go ahead.
Okay. I was totally unaware that there was an effort to get rid of me. Never knew the motivation, but there was a going away party for one of the EMTs, and so I went to the party. It was at a bar restaurant, and a good friend of mine and a really great nurse came over and grabbed me by the arm, and she says, "Let me buy you a drink." I says, "Yeah, okay, what the hell?" So we went into the bar, we ordered, and then she turned around and she looked me dead in the eye and she says, "Jim, you're in trouble. You got a problem." And I was totally blank. I said, "What's going on?" And so she gave me a brief explanation that people were saying that I had done things, and she says she knew that they weren't true, but it's getting into HR and so forth.
She says, you need to address this as soon as possible. So when I went back to work after that, I looked into it. And it was the anonymous tip line. Somebody had left a message that I had put my hands on a ward clerk in a manner in which the ward clerk appeared to be uncomfortable.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so turns out the ward clerk that I was involved in the situation was someone who was like a daughter to me. And she knew me, she knew my wife, she knew my family. And hardworking, energetic young girl. And so I needed either something ordered or something from a ward clerk position. And I needed it kind of soon. And I knew she was being overwhelmed by the events, but I thought, well, maybe I can cajole her. So I gave her a shoulder rub while she was sitting at her desk, and a doctor was right in front of us, and three or four other nurses and another ward clerk were standing around us doing their jobs. And I'm massaging her shoulders, and I says, "Hun, I really need whatever it is." And she says, "Jim, don't you see what this pile of work?" I says, "I know, but I'm giving you a free massage to help you reduce your stress or something of that nature. Just trying to entice you to put me at the head of the line." She laughed. She said, "I'll get it for you." And that was it. Well, somebody observed this, and I believe it was a woman who came in, was a head nurse for a very short time before she left. And this woman struck me as someone who was in way over their head, whose experience had been for a great number of years in a very small ER that was not a receiving center or a trauma center. So she comes into St. Francis, going to be in charge of something she doesn't know. She has to find something wrong that can deflect the attention away from her.
Yeah.
This is my take on it. Well, they called the ward clerk to the HR, and they said that they understood that I had put my hands on her in an offensive way and made her uncomfortable. And she says, "That's a lie. Never happened." They says, "Well, did he do this?" And she says, "Yeah." She says, he was so good at it that the nurses would come and stand in line for Jim to give him like a 2-minute shoulder and neck massage.
Which is actually not uncommon, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, and she says, and besides, she says, "I know Jim. I know his family. I look at him as a father figure." And she says, "Hell, he's almost the oldest nurse down here. He's the oldest man. So everybody looks to him to, you know, as a father figure. We bring our troubles, our problems, our questions, you know, because, you know, he's been around." So they couldn't get what they wanted out of that. Well, next thing I know, I was teaching LVN students and bringing to the hospital for clinical. And somebody overheard a conversation that I had with, I was thinking there were three or four of my students in the hallway. It wasn't anything behind the sheets or anything. So they reported that I had told one of my students who was going on vacation, I think it was spring break, that I should take a bikini because I thought she would probably look really hot in a bikini or something like that.
What the hell?
Okay, well, here's the story. Me and my wife and daughter and son-in-law, we went to Yosemite one year. We stayed there for a few days. And in the evening, around the campfire, the rangers will, you know, tell you about the valley and the nature and stuff. I'll also tell you incidents that have occurred that people, you know, didn't make the right choice. And then this one incident was they have a swimming pool there, Curry Village, and these two young women had went to the swimming pool. They were wearing bikinis. They came back to their tent, and they lit up their hibachi pot and threw a steak on it. while the steak was cooking, they were getting out of their swimsuits, putting on their clothes. Well, halfway through that process, a bear smelled the steak and came into the tent. They became hysterical and they split and run. Well, one girl had managed to get all of her clothes on before this happened. The other one didn't. And so she goes streaking down the main road in Curry Village, topless. So I says, you know, if you take a bikini, make sure you don't cook in your tent.
Make sure you don't cook in your what?
Tent. In your tent. So you'll attract, you know, the bears and the chipmunks and anything else. So that was the story.
Well, see how people need to mind their freaking business?
Well, yeah. So anyway, they tell me what was I was accused of on the anonymous tip line.
Wow. And,
that's when I asked them, I would like to confront my accuser. We can't do that. Why not? Then that would negate the confidentiality of the anonymous tip line. I said, have you ever read the Constitution of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
I believe somewhere there's a clause that says the accused is entitled to confront the accuser. And, well, you know, we can't do that. I said, well, obviously, this is the second time I've been down here on being misconstrued in what I said or did. So you seem to have an effort to eliminate me, and I will make it easy for you because I can get a job tomorrow.
Right.
So I quit. Yeah, there you go. But as I mentioned to Isaac earlier, I regret not pursuing that with a assistance of an attorney.
Absolutely.
My rights have been violated, as it were.
Absolutely.
So I left, and I never have ever set foot in St. Francis again.
Wow. And it's so heartbreaking because I didn't have the same type of experience, but I went through the same, I guess, kind of ordeal. Like, it wasn't harassment for me. I actually ended up reporting a doctor for his malpractice, for his bad practice. And it just became a witch hunt. And one day I looked up and a union rep, a good friend of mine, but who was also a union rep, came to me and said, they're coming after you. They want you to go. And I couldn't understand why. There was no real reason as to why I should have been let go. But they came for me. They tried to come for my MIC and, oh, well, you did this on the radio. Well, you can't get, you know, discipline for something you do on the radio. You're practicing as a nurse under a doctor, right? Long story short, I ended up leaving and I did do a wrongful termination and I actually won that case. But that wasn't the biggest issue for me. The biggest issue for me was that I considered all my coworkers family. I really did. And I felt that several of them did not have my back. Nobody went to bat for me. Everything I did for that company, everything I would jump through flaming hoops. I would work overtime. I would go in when they needed somebody. I would pick up patients when I'm in charge. I would do all kinds of stuff. And not one person had my back when they came for me.
Yeah, that's disappointing. But the environment in which I've, in my mind, conceived that you were working under was so arbitrary and dictatorial.
Oh, yeah.
Those people felt that if they spoke up for you, then the sights would be turned on them.
I'm sure.
Yeah. But that does not excuse their lack of credibility and loyalty.
I agree. So a lot of them I just cut off. You know, I cut off a lot of people, and the people that did have my back, were in my corner, did give me calls, did text me, I still keep in touch with them. you know. So I can actually only imagine what you went through, because that's kind of the environment that St. Francis was.
One of the things that really upset, now keep in mind, I was still fairly new, Beth, but I remember a lot of people being upset at how things transpired after he left.
Yeah.
And a lot of people said that you leaving Jim was a sign of the times. Was a sign of the times, and how everybody was going to treat interactions with each other differently. No one saw it as a good thing, you leaving, that is. Stephanie, when he left, people were upset because they saw it as a witch hunt also.
Oh, yeah.
It was justified. I know a few nurses who stated they were being a bit too specific and not looking at the person as a whole, the character as a whole, and looking at it in context. But they weren't. That's what upset most people, not all of them there. I'd say most, because there were a few who probably were in on him, on what happened. So they really may not have given an opinion, but the majority of the people were really upset on how it happened.
Yeah.
And just you, Bethany, when you left, everybody was on eggshells afterwards. So they said if they can do this because you have an incompetent doctor doing what the doctor does, imagine if somebody else brings it up.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. It is unfortunate. However, overall, Jim, because I don't want us to be kind of sour note here. What are your experiences as an ER nurse that were not significant to you, but felt like a positive for you?
Well, there's two that stand out in my mind. We had a young woman, a mother. I forget what was wrong with her, but she got sent home, you know, so she wasn't, you know, dire, but she was off getting x-rays, I think. And the dad was there with his daughter, and she was about 5, 6. And so I came over, introduced myself, asked the dad, did he want a cup of coffee? Asked the little girl, would she like, I don't know, what, or some juice or something. And my mother went to x-ray, so I didn't have any need to interact with them. I was dealing with my other patients. Anyway, when the lady came back from x-ray, I'll get her all hooked up again, tucked in. And the father said, Jim, my daughter wants to ask you a question. And I said, what's that, sweetheart? And she looked at me and she says, are you one of the Backstreet Boys? And you know, I wanted to crack up laughing, but I didn't want to, you know, embarrass her. And I squat down the eye level and I said, sweetheart, I'm old enough to be their granddaddy.
Aww.
Dad, he was smiling, but there was another day I had this guy who's Samoan, lived in Compton. You know, he was intimidating fellow with lots of tattoos, but, you know, he was there as a patient. He had needs. He was cordial. He was nice. So we were talking about tattoos and stuff. And then I had to go deal with another patient. And it was maybe 15, 20 minutes later, like I'm walking by, as I walked past his bed. He goes, hey, Jim, you got a second? I said, yeah, what's up? He says, well, man, you know, I got to tell you something. He says, me and my homies were sitting out on the porch a few weeks ago, passing around the 42 and the smoke. I go, sound like a good day. And he says, yeah. He says, and we were talking. We come to a conclusion. I says, what was your conclusion? And he looked at me and he says, you white guys are crazy.
Wow.
And I asked him, I just looked at him and he says, how so? He says, man, he says, you would never get us jumping out of an airplane, climbing a mountain.
I heard that.
doing the things that you guys do for fun, we would never do, because that's insane.
No way. No way.
Yeah. I want to jump on an airplane.
Hey, it's fun. I've done it 14 times.
Oh, hell no. Y'all can keep that. I'm good. If we were supposed to jump out of airplanes, God would have gave us wings.
The way Hannibal would take Dave Baracus.
Absolutely not.
And we'll jump out together.
I ain't jumping out of shit. Hell no. We do need to start kind of winding down, though. So, Jim, what I really want to know, well, I don't know if Isaac ever told you what this podcast was for, and it was basically, it is basically just like an unfiltered way for nurses to vent and kind of give a background about what we do and just let the public know, you know, stop beating us up. This is where we come from. We're human too. Okay. So, like, what do you want the public to know? What have you gotten from nursing? Like, and how does it make you look at the world? And what do you want the community to know?
I'd like the general public to have an accurate picture of the job and what it takes just to get a license in the first place. The work, the dedication, the caring, that nurses are your first line of defense. We're there all the time.
Yeah.
Doctor come in and look at you for a couple of minutes and not see you for another couple of days, but we're always there.
Yeah.
And we try to do our jobs as professional and considerate as possible. We can't always make you pains go away. We can't always answer all your questions, but we'll try. We'll try. And many times the relationships between nurse and patients can approach a level that's almost like family members.
Yeah.
Especially if it's one who's in the hospital for a long period of time. And, you know, you really get to know them. You get to know their histories, their backgrounds, their likes, their dislikes. And we're just people trying to help people.
That's right.
And provide for our families in the process. And we have good days. We have bad days like everybody else. But I think we do a better job of not letting it show and interfere in regards to our work, our activities. And at the end of the day, we go home exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the female nurses, they go home and then they got to cook and clean and take care of the kids and whatever.
Yeah.
So that's, through the things I endured, they were made a whole lot easier because I had the support of my wife and children. We're just trying to do the right thing in an area in which we're interested. And it's fascinating. And I guess that's about the bottom line, you know.
Jim, thank you very much for coming on, Bethany.
Thank you, guys. This was a great conversation. It's really good to hear from a military point of view.
Bethany, it's great to meet you. Maybe someday we'll eye to eye.
Yes.
So this podcast is aired how?
Well, I have the podcast on many platforms. It is mostly utilized on Spotify. The platform is Anchor, which I'll start to do a little bit of advertising for them shortly. But you can hear us on Spotify. We now have YouTube platform, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. So whatever platform fits for you, go ahead and click on that link. But I will be sending you a copy.
Okay. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. All right.
I'll send you a podcast, Jim.
Uh-huh.
You can listen to the other episodes. There's one with Jesus, Amarias, and myself.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll send you a link.
Yes. And you guys make sure you stay tuned because we will be coming up with more topics to include racism in healthcare, domestic violence, you know, all the way down to STDs.
Hey,
Yeah, I was in the beginning of AIDS.
Oh man, that was a huge one.
COVID was a greater disaster, but AIDS was a more tragic disaster.
That's true. That's true.
We'll definitely have to be on for part two of that, Jim.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. We'd love to have you.
All right.
Well, you guys, thank you guys for listening. Bethany, thank you for making this happen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, guys. This is the end of episode 5. Make sure you check us out on all platforms. In the meantime, keep your ass out the emergency room. Bye.